Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 495. I am currently still on vacation. This is a rerun of one of my favorite episodes from the first year of the podcast. This is part two. Part one was last week. This is part two of my interview with Greg Cheever. And our sponsor for today, as always, is the online therapy provider, BetterHelp.com. If you've never tried online therapy, I highly, highly recommend it. I've been doing it for a couple of years, and it has helped me tremendously. You don't have to leave your home. There's something really nice about that, and they have tons of great qualified therapists. So if you are interested, go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast, and then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they feel like they have a good counselor match for you, they will match you up with one, and then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is right for you. And you need to be over 18. Actually, you don't need to be over 18. To do BetterHelp, you need to be over 18. But if you're between 13 and 17, they will direct you to teencounseling.com. And they will take care of all of the stuff there, contacting the parent to get approval. And then once that's done, it's a private, everything is private between the counselor and the teen. And it meets all the legal requirements in all 50 states. All right, without further ado, this is part two with Greg Cheever. Welcome to episode 25 with my guest, Greg Cheever. This is part two of a two-part interview with him. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, an hour of honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions to everyday compulsive negative thinking, feelings of dissatisfaction, disconnection, inadequacy, and yes, that vague sinking feeling that the world is passing us by. You give us an hour, we'll give you a hot ladle of awkward and icky. But first, a few notes. The website for this podcast is mentalpod.com. That's also the Twitter name you can follow me at. If you'd like to support the show, you can also take a survey there that helps me get to know who you are. And if you want to support the show non-financially, please go to iTunes and give us a good rating. That boosts our ranking, and that helps get more people to the show, which of course, we love. Some people I want to thank that helped put this show together. I want to thank my wife, who Carla, who always gives me such great feedback. Those of you who listen that give me feedback, I want to thank you. Steve Grieve, who does the website. You can visit Steve's website. It's chromadial.com. He's a web designer and does quite a tremendous job. And I want to thank Martin Willis for helping me put some of the guest blogs together. We're in the process of doing that right now. Oh, I also want to mention that I'm going to be performing my satirical character, Republican Representative Richard Martin, at Zoe's in Ventura. Monday, September 12th. I think the show's probably around 8 or so. And a bunch of great people on the bill with me. Gray Delisle, Janet Varney, Jimmy Dore, and Eddie Pepitone, and a couple other comedians. I'd like to read a letter I got from a guy named Eli. And he writes, "Hi, big fan of the show. Just recently started listening and I'm really enjoying it. I think it probably helps a lot of people get through some tough issues and is a great public service. However, I have one bone to pick. It seems like in every interview you eventually get around to saying how the problems that anyone faces in life had to be that way to arrive at where you are now, or that the universe has a plan that includes meaningful hardship and that it all works out in the end with the person concerned being a better human being, etc. Now, I understand from a personal subjective point of view that this kind of new age reasoning can be comforting and can help individuals with personal problems, but in a larger way, it is intellectually shallow and even offensive." And then he lists a bunch of examples of horrible events from history. I don't know why kids get cancer. I don't know why there are Hitlers and why there's other kinds of shit that happens. What I do know is that there's an energy in the universe that brings me comfort when I go through painful things. And sometimes I think the universe feeds us, and sometimes I think the universe needs us to feed it and make sacrifices. And that's kind of the model that I have in my head that helps me. I have no idea if I'm anywhere near the mark. What I do know is it helps me get out of bed, it helps me smile more, and it helps me be of more service to my fellow man and my immediate family. So I keep doing that. I respect the fact that you disagree with that, and I would just ask you to extend the same respect to me. And I'm not a big fan of organized religion. I know I've put it down before on this show, and I apologize to anybody that I've offended for doing that. I'm a fan of spirituality. I'm not a fan of organized religion, but I don't begrudge anybody that uses organized religion and who finds comfort from it. You know, and some of you may be saying, what is the difference between organized religion and spirituality? Aren't they one and the same thing? And I heard somebody say one time that organized religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell, and spirituality is for people who have been there.
Everybody, yeah, I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand, yeah, you.
Yes, yeah, awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
So just to quickly recap part one with Greg, he was a heroin addict who got caught trying to sell heroin, went on the lam as he didn't show up for his court appearance, went on the lam as under the name Harry Bring for a while, was eventually caught, thrown in jail, did his time, came out still with a mean heroin habit, managed to get rehired by Fox Studios as a projectionist, and was on his third marriage, right?
Yes, I was on my third wife. Wife number two went off into oblivion to, unfortunately, later die of this disease in the streets. And wife three was a fabulous lady, the best of my four marriages as far as coming close to real love. She was a great lady. We really loved each other. We had a great passion for each other. But we were both addicts, and she was right alongside me. And her father was the head DA of Van Nuys.
Boy, you really can pick them. You really can pick them.
So, and her mom was a famous court stenographer for big cases like Manson's. And
oh, really?
And, yeah, she did all the big cases, you know. So anyways, I'm also now getting used to being with a parole officer. And
she's female.
She's female. I draw this lady parole officer. And I start to work at the studios. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, because I'm not asking too many questions or trying to raise any feathers, because I'm trying to think of how I can use until I get used to this parole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm going crazy, right? So in the meantime,
and
I
use
start
in particular heroin, because that's your drug of choice.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm starting to drink for the first time, right? I started with Tanqueray and Schweppes and limes. And I remember starting drinking, let's see, I was barely 30 then. And I really hadn't drank before that. I was a pure drug addict, right? So I started drinking these gin and tonics, and I thought, wow, that's pretty good, right? Okay, I kind of like that, right? Not my choice, but it was working.
It'll do in a pinch.
It was working, and then I started noticing that I was having to buy like a quart like every other night, right? And I just started, right? I have very monster tolerance, very high tolerance to everything. Anyway, so that gets to be a regular thing till I feel this parole thing, and then I get a call one day. I'm working at the studio. Oh, you got to come in. And I say, I say to my parole lady, I can't just leave this my job here. I'd lose my job. She says, what do you do? What are you doing again? I said, I'm a projectionist in the studio, and I happened at the time really to be working on Rocky, right? Uh-huh. Original Rocky, right? And I said, I'm working on this film. I can't leave. It's unless you're going to send me back to jail, that's the only way I'm going to leave.
Right.
Right. And she said, oh, really? I said, but I can get you a pass to come to the studio and come and get on the stage and I'll do my urine test for you here. She goes, you can? And as I found out, she was complete movie junkie, right? There's another got shot, right?
Right.
Because you're talking about a 7-year testing parole unless you do 2 years completely clean every time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she told me she'd never, ever had anybody do it. And when I did it on everybody else's pee but mine, because she would come into the projection booth, into the studio, and I'd take her down on the mixing stage and whatever, right? And say, you can sit back here and listen to and watch him mix. That's a director, and there's the composer over there. And these are the sound mixers, Oh, my God, right. She'd sit in the back, she'd give me the bottle, and I'd run upstairs and get some clean pee, right?
She wasn't supposed to watch you pee?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Yeah.
All I know is I did that for 2 years, and she was, like, so proud of me. And I was gouged the whole time.
Wow.
Right.
Gouged meaning high on heroin?
Yeah. And both of us, both me and Georgia, my wife number three, yes, she was right there in there with me. So I'm working at Warner Hollywood, and I start to, there's this famous mixer in Hollywood is on this stage with me. Everybody wants to bring his big films to him. He's booked for 2 years solid.
Wow.
All the big films came to this guy. And he loved me. And he was a normal guy married into this, suburban family, but brilliant man, brilliant historian, brilliant, unbelievable mind. And he starts kind of getting interested in...
And what was the guy's name?
Richard Portman.
Mm-hmm.
He won the Oscar for The Deer Hunter. So anyways, he starts kind of interested in my life and what's going on. And I had this big, spacious booth that was like its own little, about the size of this room we're in here. It was fabulous. With a big bay window, ice box, and Kleiner's in it. And
this was his office or yours?
This was my booth, room I actually worked in every day. Right. Yeah. And it was the most technical and advanced stage in Hollywood. It was the first high-speed stage anywhere in the business, actually. It was like a prototype stage.
And your job basically was to get the...
the film that had been rough edited from the editors or the director and to put it up so the studio and the director could sit in the same room and look at a rough cut, correct?
Well, there's many different jobs of a projectionist because there's many different ways the films and its application are used until it's put into a composite form. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing like a scoring session back then, because the movie doesn't have music going all the way through it, right, they cut out what's called big loops, and you put certain loops up. It'd be like CM12, which would be cue music 12, right? And that's what's down the sheets down there, and you put it in a hot hole, and you'd run this big loop over and over and over through a 35 millimeter loop through the projector.
And they'd do pass after pass after pass of the music until
they got
it right.
Yeah, and there'd be streamers that go across the street, and that's when the downbeat's supposed to stop.
Right.
And these are all prepared by an editor, and they're handed to you, and then they tell you over the mic, you know, Q13, Q14, whatever, or M12 or whatever. So, and you just put the right stuff up and whatever. Now, dubbing, they do a reel at a time, and they put them on high-speed projectors, and that's interlocked and sunk to the soundtracks that they're mixing to. Mm-hmm. And then the sound recorders are mixed to that. Are locked to that, and it's all interlocked right to the perf, right?
And the perf is the holes in the film itself.
Yeah, there's four perfs per frame. So actually, there's eight perfs per frame. Really, it's a trick question on the projectionist.
Four on each side.
Thing. Yeah. And then there's tons of there's picture and track like you were talking about when they come in from dailies. The track is separate from the dailies. And then there's composite, then there's 70 millimeter, there's 35 millimeter, there's kinetons, there's probably 14 or 15 different types of applications and different types of projectors, and that as a projectionist in a major lot, depending on where the film is in its post-production journey. Mm-hmm. So, and I was good. I was really good at it. I have a very mechanical mind. Like I said, I used to race and build cars. It just came to me really easy, really fast, and it was once you got it down, I could do it really loaded,
yeah,
completely out of it, completely. You know,
I think I saw your movie Cheever Fully Loaded.
So I'm working with this guy who had this plan that he'd been working in on the side that nobody knew about, that Robert Altman was going to build him his own stage in his own facility in off Bundy. In West Hollywood, that was about ready to come into fruition. So he does. He leaves, and I continue on. Another mixer comes in, does his job, and I get a call about 2 weeks later, and he says, "Hey, you want to come to work for me?" I said, "What?" Everybody's like that. So that's when I went over, and then he says, "Look, I don't know if I can pay you what you're making now." He said, "All I can pay you is like $650 a week." Right, which was a lot of money back then, right? You're talking 35 years ago, right?
Which would be what, 76? Something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so, anyways, what happens is we go to Lionsgate, and it's Robert Altman's studio. It's all financed by Fox, you know, creator of MASH.
The movie.
MASH the movie, and he sold the rights to the TV thing for $10,000. Yeah. Nobody knows that. But his son worked there. And anyways, Lionsgate became this incredible, unbelievable, you know, private, unionized studio. And Dick brought all of his big clients with him. Made it, at the time, as high-tech as it could be. Robert Altman was a big, you know, he used to send his weed down for me to roll every day, right? And he didn't care what you did there as long as you got your work done.
Right.
Right? And it was really, really on there. So crazy. This guy comes to me and says, my cousin works at Pfizer, right? He's like one of the top chemists over at this Pfizer or whatever, and I think I'd get a bunch of drugs from him. What kind would you like? I said, oh, yeah, sure. I was like, kind of blew him off, And he came back and he says, really, do you want anything? So just give me a list and I'll see if I can. So I gave him a list of, you know, Dilatas, Two and Alls, on and on and on. Some of the strongest narcotics ever. And he comes in with bottles of 200 and 500 of these things one day. Right? He says he wants $1,000 for this. It was it was about $15,000.
That's a drug addict Christmas.
Yeah.
You're not going to see that airing on WGN, but that is a drug addict Christmas.
And proceeded to get the whole place strung out. Everybody was just like, everybody was doing hard narcotics. Everybody was just, it was, and so now I'm married to Georgia, number three, mm-hmm. and she's pregnant. I'm now living in Venice. Things are really out of control. I'm really, really getting hooked on booze and heroin. Mm-hmm. But the booze is really killing me, really, because for me, the alcohol was harder than any narcotic, and I crossed a lot more moral boundaries on alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it physically tears you up so much, and I never went into blackouts on narcotics, and I was starting to do that on booze.
And alcohol gives you an aggressive edge that narcotics, I think, probably don't.
Yeah, I was a.
You don't see many heroin addicts getting in fist fights, do you?
No, you don't. No, it's a very passive drug, very laid back, and whatever. But alcohol never did that to me either. You know, a lot of people it can do that too. I have been really crazy on it and whatever. And now my wife has had our first child, and we're living in Venice. I'm really in bad shape, really, really bad. But I'm managing to get enough narcotics in me to keep me standing up, you know, because I was really getting towards the bottom, and she was really getting worried. And I just remember Georgia, you know, starting to completely disconnect from me, because when she had that baby, that's when she had her spiritual experience, you might say, because she was just as hooked as me, and she disconnected completely from that. She had decided that...
she needed to get her priorities in shape.
I'd never seen anything like it to this day. And she got to a point with me to where we finally lost the house in Venice. We ended up in Silver Lake, living in a kind of a back bedroom of her grandparents. And she put me in the car one day and drove me down the middle of Hollywood. And said, I can't watch you kill yourself anymore, you know. Gave me this key, standing on the street off of Gower, and said, down that driveway there's a room in there. I love you dearly, and I just can't watch you kill yourself anymore. And it was one of those snapshot memories up here, because when I was standing on that street, that car pulled away, and my daughter in the back seat,
oh,
with her eyes kind of looking at me as she rolled away. And I was really, really bad. Really bad.
This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And so I went and proceeded to try and just basically drink myself to death in this place. And I ended up losing that place, ended up out on the streets. And then a high school friend of mine.
Were you working at this time or no?
I was working very little. By this time, I had run my gamut through all the studios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew enough not to take a call if I couldn't make it to it the next day or whatever. I had no car. I had no nothing. That's why she gave me a place in the middle of Hollywood. And I was alcohol poisoned most of that time. But what happened from there was, you know, very close to where I hit my bottom. But I ended up out on the street from there. I didn't know where my daughter or her were. And I was in blackouts most of the time. And I was still trying to get as much heroin and cocaine or anything else I could in myself. But I really didn't have any money. And I used to run into the markets and fill up the cart. And before they used to put the locks on the big bottles and the and whatever, I'd get to the end of the reel and I'd drink almost a quart inside the market at like 3 or 4 in the morning, the all night markets.
So you wouldn't have to pay for it?
Yeah.
And they wouldn't.
I'd just act like I was shopping, you know, and fill the cart up with all the most expensive stuff.
Yeah.
And then on the turn of the end of the aisle,
just leave it
past the mirrors.
Yeah.
I would just stop there and just down as much as I could.
You're not the first person I've heard talk about that.
Yeah, and did that for a long time. But anyways,
we have a mutual friend Tim who what forced him to finally get sober was he was in a Ralph's chugging as much of a thing of rot gut vodka as he could while the security guard was chasing him around the store, and he had a roast chicken down his pants. And this Mexican guard is chasing him around screaming, Alcoholico, Alcoholico. Yeah. And he was living on a porch swing in Venice. And he called a friend of ours up named Kenny Bob and said, was telling him what was going on. And living on the porch swing. And Kenny Bob said to him, you know, if you keep drinking, you could lose that porch swing.
You could lose that. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
So, okay. So
that is so cool. I've heard that story and I know who you're talking about. And that is so funny.
Yeah. And he's a great guy.
Yeah. Fabulous guy.
Turned his life around.
Yeah. Big time. Like I said, I lose that place. I end up on the streets. But before I got to that point and before things got so horrible after I left Lionsgate, I went back out on the daily circuit. And now I'm very intoxicated in blackouts all the time. Passing out and coming to, I'm towards my end. I'm towards it all crashing and burning down. I'm 33 years old, 33 and a half years old. You know, I had to drink to survive these days. So, and I never knew when a blackout was going to happen. Sometimes it could be just 6 ounces, or sometimes it could be 16 ounces, or sometimes it wouldn't happen. And that's what blackouts are for most drunks that are in that spot. So. But I would do these crazy things at blackouts. And so I'm on a pretty good roll working at Warner Hollywood. I've been there for about a month and a half. They like me. I'm doing okay. I'm staying out of everybody's face. I'm just got a nice little job working where I can drink and do my deal and go home. And they put me on this night show there running this movie. A big preview deal, right? And they were always very trusting of my talent. I was always very good at what I did. And that's one thing that I think allowed me to survive so long on the circuit out there is I was very qualified. And So I'm running this back in the day when they had previews at actually studios before they would take them to, you know, like the Grumman's or something like mm-hmm. they do now or whatever. They actually had, they'd do their own previews on the lots with the spotlights and they'd call the local press in and they would do their little, you know, they do their little audio recordings, much like we're doing, you know, mm-hmm. for the stars and stuff. And they'd have the spotlights going and make a big hoo-ha. The head of the studio would come and the directors, producers, cast and crew, the regular deal. And I can't remember which film it was, but it was a pretty big film. And I'm running in the main theater at Warner Hollywood. And everything's going along fine. I start and I get like in the second or third reel. It's a very warm night. There's no air conditioning in the booth. Arc lights for the lights for the projectors, which are very hot. And I've got my shirt off. And I got my vodka bottle on the electrical gutter right next to the projector. It's a nice big cord of probably Kamchatka or something. And I'm slugging away at it and whatever. And I'm checking the screen and I'm making sure everything's going. And I'm changing between the A projector and the B projector and everything's going fine. And then we get to the scene on the outside and I look out the port and I notice this hair up caught in the aperture. Mm-hmm. In the sky scene, you could really see it really apparent. Yeah. It was very irritating, you know, moving real quick yeah. and wiggling all over the screen. It's covering half the screen, right?
Yeah.
And so we have our ways to get out of there. I run over the compressed air and shoot it into the aperture. It doesn't move. I flick the aperture with my hand. It doesn't move. I spit on the edge of the film. It doesn't move. Now we have another little trick we do where we loosen the back plate of the thing and throw some air in behind there. The film goes out of focus just a little bit, but mm-hmm. that's the last escape, right? And then you tighten it back up. I could not get that hair off the screen, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of like the last thing I remember is using every trick I knew in the book to try and do this. Now, the next thing I remember is being woken up by a janitor in a utility closet, one building over, with my wife and my six-month-old daughter in her arms, with this janitor standing next to him, both looking at me with their jaws dropped. And as I come out of this blackout, everything kind of goes back in reverse in my head, like wind a tape back.
Right.
Like, oh my God. I knew where I was when I came out of it because I used to shoot heroin in that closet, uh-huh. right? And everything went back, and as everything went back, I'm rising up off the ground. And as I'm rising up off the ground, I realize I have no clothes on. Right? Right? So everybody, they're both looking, they don't know what to say, but my wife and this janitor, right? And all I know is that she had my pants on her hand. I threw the pants on because I knew I had to get back to that screening before that reel ran out. Because usually in a motion picture, there's 8 different reels. You guys never see it when you see them. It's not that way anymore. But back then, it used to be 2 projectors, and you had to make these changeovers between the reels. Mm-hmm. Each one is approximately about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? And if you aren't there, when that runs out, it goes to white on the screen and no sound. It's just white light going out yeah. through the lens.
Yeah.
And not only will it burn a lens to pieces, but the take-up reels in the bottom have such torque on them that it'll shred the film. So as I'm tearing back to this one building, down these stairs, I come out and there are all these people milling around. It was an upstairs theater. They're all kind of milling around the parking lot. And they're all kind of looking up at the projection booth. And they just kind of look aimless, right? And I come tearing around the corner. I come up the stairs. I come up. And as I'm approaching the stairway to come into the booth, I notice little chunks of film flying out, right? And then I, you know, as I'm coming out that back door and I see all the people around, I know I'm already really, something's really drastically yeah. long. But I'm already in motion. I just got to go for it. And so now here's kind of really the cruncher of the whole thing. Okay. So I shut the film down. I close everything up. I go home, right?
Yeah.
George is like, I don't know what the hell happened back there, but I don't think it was good, Greg. Right? and I'm like, whatever. Okay. Yeah, I know. I'm going to get help for it tomorrow, whatever. So I come in for my call the next day, right? And it was an 8 o'clock call in the morning on a dub stage. And it's like the second hand hit eight and the phone rings, right? And it's the head of the department on there. He goes, God damn it, Cheever. Oh, I wish I could have been there. Why wasn't I there? Oh my God, that's unbelievable. I am so pissed off I couldn't have been there. Well, of course you're fired, but why couldn't have I be there, right? And I'm going, why? What are you talking about? I said, I know I screwed up and whatever like that. And so here's what happened. Somewhere when I blacked out trying to get that hair out of the aperture, and I don't remember the next thing I remember is waking up in a utility closet.
Right, but the one thing you had told me when you told me this story before, use the phrase you used to like to do when you'd get loaded with your clothes.
Oh, nude up. Oh, yeah, that was a natural, yeah. And so I guess this is what happened in the blackout, because you're right. Every time I would go home when I was loaded, I would just take all my clothes out. I've been doing that for years.
Yeah.
Right? And I still have this naked thing going. Whatever.
So you're nude up.
I'd nude up, right. So anyways.
So you're in the booth nuded up, apparently.
I had no idea this happened until I came in that next morning. Right.
Right.
When he's making such this statement like, right. Oh, did I miss? Oh, my God. Right.
Right.
And he's doing it with enthusiasm like, this has got to be one of the best. This is going to be legendary in the business, right? So in my blackout, somewhere in my twisted thinking in that blackout, I figured that hair was out on the screen. And I better take off all my clothes to go see if it is. Right? So I take off all my clothes. I walk out of the booth. I walk down the hallway. I walk up to the emergency doors that are right by the screen. They're exit doors, actually. Right?
And there are how many people watching this screening?
Oh,
this
it's a completely full theater of like 250, maybe 300.
VIPs.
Yes, VIPs. Head of the studio there, right? And director, the whole
thing. And you can't remember what movie it was.
I know, I can't.
Yeah.
Everything was so overpowering, whatever. Yeah. I probably could if I really thought about it. I'll find out.
All right.
Anyways, it's really, really funny. And the story kind of followed me for a long time. Yeah. But I have this compressed air can in my hand. So this exit door near the screen, everybody's watching the film. It's running fine. There's a hair up there, though.
In your mind.
Yeah. Well, though there was a hair. But I know that. I know that for a fact before I blacked out.
But it wasn't on the screen. In your drunken state, you thought the hair was on the screen, not in the camera, because you couldn't get it out of the camera.
Well, that's the whole insanity of the story,
right?
Because here's what happened. When I opened up that door and walked out across the screen naked, right? And this is a lower screen. You could probably see my kiwili hanging out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was full aperture type picture. The floor was almost on the picture was almost on the floor, and I walk out in front of it, and I take this compressed air air can,
yeah.
and I point it up towards his hair, and I start spraying it, and when everybody, first of all, when they saw me, they freaked out, but when they saw that,
yeah.
That's when they knew something was really twisted, right? And according to my boss, they started exiting out the rear doors. They just started leaving right then. They didn't even wait for the film to run out. They just start like, and I wander off into this blackout and pass out in this utility closet, right? So that's when my boss is, I'm trying to figure out, he's like, God, I wish I could have been there. And he's so enthusiastic and like, oh my God.
Oh, I wish I could have been there.
He's like, you know, and just a kind of undertone. Oh, by the way, you're fired. And yeah. Why couldn't I? You know?
So that was one of the four studios.
That was one of the four studios. And then the Ordinary People one was for Columbia when it was on the Warner Brothers lot, but it was a Columbia film. And it was Robert Redford's debut as a director.
Yeah, and it was a great movie. Won a bunch of Oscars.
Yeah, fabulous movie.
Yeah.
And it just been shown. It was the first rough cut. It was really long. It was over 3 hours. It was in picture and track format, which means the track, the actual audio track, is separate on 35 millimeter, but separate magnetic track from the picture, and they both have to be sunk up. And when it's in an editorial form like that, a 3 hour picture with being picture and track would be approximately 34 separate reels of film.
So a lot of work.
So anyways, I'm running this. I get to where this film had just been run in New York at Magno for some other people, for the Warner Brothers people over there. And it was late coming back, and there were a lot of very high-powered people waiting to see this film from Warner Brothers and Columbia, including Robert Redford. And the film hadn't shown up yet. The flight was late. The Teamsters bring in the film finally. I'm waiting. The auditorium's waiting. Usually they prepare that film, the editors do, before they even they bring it in a day early and check it all. So I'm loaded out of my mind up there. I'm drinking. I'm hot. I've got my tank. I got my wife beater on.
Are we nuded up? Oh, I guess not if you got the wife beater on.
No, I got the wife beater on, yeah. The Levi's and whatever. And so the film finally comes in. I open it up, and it's a mess. There's film all over the place. The tapes all come undone, so it's kind of unspooled everywhere. I find the first couple reels. I get them up on the projectors. I take off. I figure, and these are short reels. They're only 8 minutes a piece or whatever. But I get everything turned around. I'm good. I can do it. That was my mistake, right? And
this is before you had realized the power of asking for help. You were still in your
yes.
ego of, I can do this all on my own.
Absolutely.
Right, because you were handed basically a tub of shit,
yes.
Technically.
Yeah.
But you didn't. You had to be Superman.
And it also goes back to being on the edge.
Yeah.
Like all my stuff as a young boy, you know, the throwing of the rocks, the dealing the dope, goes right back to there too.
Yeah.
It's like I can pull this off. I can get so close, but if you don't, you're
going to crash and burn.
Yeah. And so I got on 5 or 6 reels in, and the picture breaks. And I had to, you know, like I say, it's picture and track and center locked together. So I had to stop and turn on the house lights. And the editor comes back up and says, what happened? You know, and I said, I just gave the guy a look like, are you kidding me? You know, what do you mean, what happened? Well, I said, one of your splices came apart. One of your, you know, million splices you have in this thing here. Mm-hmm. And so I said, don't worry, I can sync it up without taking it back to the bench. I'll be up in a few minutes. He's okay, all right. He goes back down. Start rolling, get another half hour, 45 minutes into the film. Another one breaks, right? Oh, God, you know, he keeps coming up. And this is really nothing about my operation at all. Everything was in sync. Everything was in focus. Everything was, changeovers were happening. I film all over the place.
Right.
But I was getting it on the screen. As far as they were concerned, it was a good screening. It didn't start, keep breaking. But the final time, the third time, it kind of a key part of that picture, almost a turning point in the whole film. The picture breaks, and I know most people have probably seen this, but it broke in the aperture and the hot hole of the picture and did one of those
melty.
Yeah, it did a poop, little hole, and then it burns all the way across the screen.
Yeah.
Melted all the way across the screen, right? And house lights come on. I turn everything on. I stop the projectors. This time I got to really do some work on it because I got to put a piece of slug in it and make sure it's in sync. I'm thrashed, man. I'm thrashed by now. And I got that bottle on the gutter, and I'm hitting that vodka hard. And this time I'm down by the lower magazine projectors, between the two projectors, trying to sync up this film. Got a splicing block down there trying to slug this hole that's in the picture. And Robert Redford comes up, and he's got both his hands, one on one lamp house and one on the other. He's got his feet spread apart, and he says, what the fuck is going on here, right? And I'm not this type of guy, but something happened that day. I snapped. I didn't say anything, but I turned my head like kind of real
like
razor fast, and I looked up at him, and he knew as soon as I looked at him that something was wrong,
yeah.
Right? And he took his hands off the lamp house, and he backed up, right? And I stood up, and I said, And I just started walking towards him. And he's backpedaling now, mm-hmm. out of the booth. And I said, "Get the fuck out of here." And he's like, "What? What?" I said, "Get the fuck out of my booth. Get out of here!" Right now, he's going back down the stairs, right. Walking backwards downstairs. And he's like, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, "I don't give a fuck who." I chase him down the hall, right outside the theater, and he's going up to this little hallway that goes into the doors of the theater. And I chase him up there, and he's still kind of walking backwards, yeah. forwards, right?
Yeah.
Just yelling and talking at me, right? And I catch the door as it's starting to close when he's in there, and right before I slam it, I say, "Stay the fuck in there," right? And nobody, I went up, finished the film, nobody came up in the booth after that, right?
Yeah.
But next day I got that call. And they, it was from New York, and they said, "I just want you to know this is a call from Warner Brothers in New York, and did you run a film for Robert Redford last night?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And they said, "Could you tell us exactly what happened?"
And they also told you that the phone call was being recorded, right?
Oh yes, yeah. Oh yeah, they said it's being recorded. Yeah. So I told them exactly what happened. I was truthful with them and told them. That I got upset and chased Mr. Redford out of the booth and down the hallway and back into the theater.
Yeah.
And so that was that. I had another, that's another one where they put one of those.
Do not let this guy in.
And so, you know, there's another one where I was doing a big screening, a 70mm six track screening of Mary Poppins.
Uh-huh.
At
the original?
Yeah.
When it first came out.
Yeah. At MGM.
Yeah.
And this is one of my first ones. This is when I first started smoking dust.
Yeah. I love that a guy showing Mary Poppins is high on angel dust.
It's, yeah. It's six track 70mm. The highest technology of its time ever. Yeah. I mean, you know, this 70mm was just recently created, and six tracks film with it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, six track magnetic on the. Anyways, we'd been doing print checks all day between that and Grand Prix, mm-hmm. another 70mm six track Frankenheimer film. Okay, so this is a big screening. It was Mary Poppins. Is this is in the MGM Grand Theater, one of the biggest theaters in Hollywood on a major lot,
mm-hmm.
700 seats,
yeah,
right? And everything's going along fine, except when we were doing all those print checks and everything, somehow a reel of Grand Prix got put into the Mary Poppins mix, right? Oh, God. And they all look the same. You got to understand.
Yeah.
They're all in the exact same kind of reels. They look the same type of film. It's just a name. One says Grand Prix. The other one says Mary Poppins. They could both be real sixes, and they were. But one was Grand Prix. Right? So they're singing a lot. It's just this real touching singing song, you know, of Mary Poppins. And I change right over into this. Probably 120 dB of a camera on the back of a Grand Prix car, right? like that, like
just,
you know,
jolted people out of their seats.
And when it, you know, you monitor everything from the booth and whatever. And it was like, you know, it was like the wave. Everybody, when it happened, I saw the whole audience kind of go, just kind of leaned forward like a wave going simultaneous. It was. And then I saw people start getting up in the aisle, right? Start running up the, because I got to stop the film.
Right.
I got to stop the film. I got to change the reel.
And right.
They're going to be up there screaming at me. So first thing I did is I run over and I locked the door.
Uh-huh. Because you don't want help.
I don't want help.
You don't want to get yelled at.
I want to get the film back on the screen as fast as I can, right? But while I'm doing this, my conniving mind is thinking of a way out. Okay, so I get the right reel back up. I start it, and what I do, because all those prints, MGM had their own lab at the time, came out of the MGM mm-hmm. lab. I go over and I cut the two, I take at the splice of the lead, front leader, I switched the two things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it really happened.
So to cover your ass.
Right, right. So they come flying. I finally unlocked that door. I said, man, I'm sorry. I just wanted to get the right thing up here, you know. It's the last thing I need you guys yelling at me.
So you made it look like somebody else's fuck up.
So they come, what the fuck happened? I said, not me, man. Take a look at this, man. I show him the leader.
Yeah.
Right? I pull it down. I put it up to the light. I show him the picture in it. And there it is with a Mary Poppins yeah. head leader with a Grand Prix race car. Right? Right. And, yeah, somebody got hung out big time in the lab for that. But I got out of it.
Wow. Wow, the wreckage that you caused.
Oh, I could go on and on. It goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
But one day, everything's gone in my life. I'm really, really sick, physically sick.
And this is how many years ago?
This was in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So getting close, you know, 29 and a half years ago. So... And one day, I've been passing out coming to for years, Paul, whatever. And one day I come to in that bedroom, and it was sky blue. The bedroom was painted sky blue. And I come to, and I don't know where it came from, but I just said, God, either help me or take me. And I remember the sunlight coming in the level or blinds in the morning, about 10 o'clock, I guess. And the next thing I remember sitting in the same place, like it was edited together, was the sun setting and coming in the opposite side of the levelers on the other side of the room. But on the other side, as I came out of that other side, it wasn't a white light experience. It wasn't a time traveling thing. It was just an absence of time. But one half of the disease that almost killed me and many other people and pushed me to do such horrible things where I couldn't get the key off, the mental part was gone, completely gone. I was still physically hooked. I had a habit, but with the with the mental obsession gone, yeah. with I got to drink, I got to use, I got to get something in me, I have to, I can't survive life without it, I can't stop.
Yeah.
Was completely gone. And my friend came home that night and he looked at me and I'll never forget what he said. You know, he said, the pain's gone from all your face.
Wow.
You know, I said, I haven't drank today. I remember I started crying. And see, the most important day of my life, beyond my kids being born, beyond anything, that day, right there, that moment.
So something changed. Deep.
Yeah.
Deep inside you.
That day was one of those days where I didn't understand really what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew something had a psychic lifted. Change in me.
Yeah.
And I remember I was liberated. I was free and I knew it, but I couldn't explain it. And I was afraid to even say anything about it because I was so exhilarated with this possibility of this actually staying with me. Because here I was in the bondage of chemicals for a long, long time. And when I realized there was a way out a few years prior to that, I had surrendered to the fact that I was going to die an addict alcoholic in my early 40s.
Really?
I totally had surrendered to that, and I accepted it. And I remember in my head running this little scenario down that would say, you know what, Greg, you really had it going on. You know, you were an athlete. People loved you in high school. You had, you know, you're a good-looking, successful guy in the studios. You had it all right there.
You scared Robert Redford?
I terrorized a lot of people and had
you
a lot of fun.
You nude it up at a premiere?
Had a lot of fun doing it. And so I was kind of just in this still zone, in the now, completely in the now for like the first time maybe ever that I'd really experienced that on a psychic level.
Yeah.
And without chemicals. Now I'm still, you know, going to have to do the shake and bake because I'm physically hooked.
Right.
You know, but the obsession of the mind part,
right,
was completely removed, gone. And I did. I shake and baked for about 2 or 3 days, and I ended up going where I needed to go to get some help, which was a place for me that was very special. And I started this journey of a sober life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was bankrupt in all areas. The friends whose house I was staying at was, let me stay there for no rent. I eventually, within 2 or 3 months, got pretty healthy. And it was like I was hatched out of a cocoon again. And it was like this new Greg came back and I have a very, I have a very good, strong, incredibly strong DNA and healthy body, which was good and bad. It's good now that I'm on the, you know,
the clean
among
side.
The living and right. On the clean side. But when I was out there, it allowed me to take it to levels that even some of my sickest friends that were in addiction with me,
right,
were like, I can't believe you. You're like unbelievable.
Yeah.
In fact, there were a lot of people that wouldn't let me fix in their house because they would see how much I'd put in the spoon. And I said, there's no way. I'm not having an overdose here.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, I've never done heroin, so I'm not familiar with, like, what's a smaller or larger amount. I suppose it depends on the potency of it.
It depends on, yeah, what was on the streets at that time and, you know, whether you were shooting a half a gram or you're shooting 3/4 of a gram or you're shooting a couple tenths or a tenth. It depended on the potency and what type of drug was on the street then. But at that time, it was what was called salt and pepper heroin, which was raw Mexican heroin cut with lactose.
So you'd shit yourself a little bit later?
No. That's kind of a fallacy, really. That doesn't, yeah. Because, well, for one thing, any opiate is extremely constipating.
Yeah.
I'm serious. There would be times I wouldn't.
I was on Vicodin for a while after a surgery. Yeah. You don't have to tell me.
Yes. Yes. And that resulted many years later of a full hemorrhoid surgery, which was a brotherhood of its own. That is, anybody that's had that one. So I start on this journey, and I'm living at my buddy's house, and I had no wheels, and I'm taking buses around. And about 4 months in, I go back to number 3, who has my daughter now, that's 2.5. And she sees this unbelievably, completely different Greg. And
this was the wife who pulled away, who left you off at the motel, and you watched your little girl wave to you in the back window or look at you.
Yeah. And see, there was this deep connection between us because like I said, maybe this was the only woman I was really in love with, and she was in love with me. But it was hard to describe that and identify it because it was so layered down in addiction, you know.
I mean, you know, one of the hallmarks to me of addiction is the inability to describe your feelings. I think it's one of the reasons why we run to drugs and alcohol is because it's just a feeling in our gut that we need to avoid. And we're so bad at articulating what it is that we're we're feeling. And to me, you know, there's like, to me, there's two steps in recovering from drugs and alcohol. The first one is beginning to know what it is that you're feeling, that you're trying to run from. And then the second phase is being able to express that to other human beings so that you can have healthy relationships.
Yeah.
But but in the beginning, you don't even know. You just know, I want to punch a wall. I don't want to punch a wall. I want to get fucked up. I don't want to get fucked up. I want to kill myself. I want to live.
Yes, absolutely. And for me, being a passive, nonviolent person, I was a containment.
Yeah.
I would contain every emotion within me. And that came from, you know, that pomp, power, prestige thing that I was brought up with. I really think that's was sprung board out of my motherboard, so to speak, or the way I was raised by environment and people at the time, which were my parents, and the society that surrounded it. So here I am, this guy that can't act out in any kind of violent way because it just wasn't part of me. At the same time, I had these great gifts of forgiveness that I got from my dad and understanding. But the emotional part that you're talking about, to mentally try and put that out, was way too much fear.
Yeah.
There was that I wouldn't do it right, or that I would look weak,
mm-hmm.
or that I would look like I needed help.
And that, let's stop there for a second. The fear of looking weak, I think that kills more people than anything. And yet it is, once you're unafraid to look weak, there is such freedom on the other side of that. Life becomes so much easier if you can just accept it. You know what? Some people might think that I'm weak. Some people might think that, you know, this or that. But if you can accept that and not care about that, man, that is the door, the doorway to such incredible freedom. But for most people, and men especially, that and if you were raised with a dad who was stoic and macho,
how scared I was when I knew my father was close to passing. And could I find the emotion to feel, to dedicate, to let out when he passed, you know?
And how long had you been sober when he passed?
5 years.
Yeah.
And I was the one that pulled the plug on him, you know?
Really?
Yeah. There wasn't a do not resuscitate sign, right? A DNR, so... So basically at that time, this was in 87, if I was to say, you couldn't at that time, you had to just let the process take its,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that's what the last thing that he wanted, but now he's in a coma. He can't tell anybody that, please, you know, take me off life support. So I would sit there next to him and, I remember I'd sit there next to him, and I would just sit and just kind of hold his hand and look and just say, I remember thinking this all the time, you know, how did I deserve such a great father, you know? And because, see, now all those layers of numbness are starting to come off, and now I'm starting to feel, really feel, right? And I'm starting to realize some of the stuff that he inputted to me, mainly by example, mainly just by half a dozen little things that stood out in my mind as a kid that he passed on to me, you know. And they were experiences that we had together. If it was going to a market and walk out of a market, and one day he says, oh, come on back with me. And I walk back to the market with me, and he hands the cashier $10, says, you gave me too much money. Mm-hmm. That's it. We get in the car, we drive home. And he says, son, you know why I did that? And I said, no, why would you do that, Dad? Mm-hmm. You know, and he says, because you'll be repaid tenfold somewhere along your life, and it may not be in money. Right. And I remember those things, you know. Mm-hmm. and so I'm sitting there with him one day, and I noticed that his head shifts, and I see his eyes kind of flutter. And I stand up and I get down close to him. And, you know, another shot from wherever, this great creator of this universe or whatever you want to call it, you know, he whispers, I want to meet my maker.
Wow.
And yeah, I was like, you know, it was like, it was beyond a chill that went through me, you know. And I stood up and it was instantaneous. I knew from that moment on what I was going to do. And I went and got a registered nurse, an ambulance service. I told them to come in there. And they went straight in there and started unhooking him. And they came in and said, what are you doing? You can't do this. The Ventura DA can file on you, you know. Go ahead and file. And I took him home, and he died in the front room with the family around him looking out on the golf course.
Wow.
2 days later, you know. So those gifts and the alignment of that synchronicity mm-hmm. in my life as, at that time, I was 40 years old.
By the way, you're not the first friend of mine that that did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine, unless it's clear in your mind that that's what you should do, I can't imagine how tough that's got to be for somebody. But what a gift to have that be very clear in your mind
yeah.
that that's what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. So let's fast forward.
I get my daughter back,
mm-hmm.
Who was 2.5 at the time. I start to work back in the studios, working the daily board. I'm working a lot of different studios. People see a different Greg physically. I give 110%. The years move on. I had my daughter through these years, didn't miss one weekend from Friday night to Sunday evening. For 12 years straight. So she kind of grew up, you know, around the new Greg, around the new process, around all the friends that were involved in my new life. And it's like I entered a new world because that old life and those old people just were no longer a part. Now, I had people that I'd known forever. I was kind of a pack leader amongst our group of guys that were all, some of them, a lot of them dead, some of them in jail, and some of them living the good life, you know, clean and sober. But so I'd go by their house like every week, whatever, for years. Right? And eventually they start showing up at my door. You know, they hit their bottom. I guess it's about three of them. Three of them have over 25 years now. You know? And I'm going to one of his weddings on Friday, actually. Great stuff. That's all wonderful. Me and my daughter built this incredible kind of special relationship, right? So she's at the age of 10, and she's asked in school to write a paper that she'd have to share in front of the class about who was her hero. She knows everything about the past. She knows everything, right? So she writes this paper on, my hero is Harry Bring, right? And she does this whole story about Harry Bring and what he did and what he was like. And then what happened, right? It's just unbelievable that I got the sheet and I laminated it and put it in a case and it's, you know, it's on my mantle, right? And it's just heartbreaking, right? but such a great piece because Harry Bring turns into her father, right?
Wow.
You know, as you get sober, you realize that it's really the inside stuff that runs your life and makes you happy and content.
Yeah.
And emotionally content.
Yeah.
And that energy from the inside is what really runs your life on the outside.
Yeah.
But as the outside stuff starts coming into you, those all take responsibilities.
Yeah.
Those big houses, those nice cars, those schools, those ballet, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Right.
And your ego ever so slowly begins to get its little badger claws into that.
Absolutely.
And before you know it, they're in so deep.
Absolutely. And the worst thing, as you know, for us is we have the disease of more. So yeah. We can never, ever fulfill that shiny, important, good-looking image stuff. We'll never, ever get to a place there where we're happy.
Because that
won't make us happy.
It won't. But the hit, the initial hit of it is so intoxicating.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you want more of it. It is. There's a million different drugs that we can be addicted to.
Yeah.
We can be addicted to compliments. We can be addicted to you know, a fast car.
Absolutely.
We could be addicted to the internet, to video games. I mean, yeah. We don't do five. I mean, we do zero or 10.
Absolutely right. And see, I think what it happens here is the unconscious self-deception of me, and I think a lot of addicts and alcoholics, it's buried so deep and is layered so camouflaged, so intricately, mm-hmm. that really we there's no way we can see it unless we're in the process of, you know, writing and somebody that's been there that can really pull that out of you.
And being honest with people every day who are just like you and talking to them and talking about your feelings, because mm-hmm. sometimes we don't know what's going on until we start talking about it.
Exactly.
And if we sit in a chair and try to figure it out ourselves, you're going to the enemy to try to find out how to defeat the enemy. Well, of course, your broken brain is going to give you the worst advice imaginable. It's going to say, you just need to sit here and get away from everybody and figure this out on your own.
That's right.
Because it's nice and safe here in the Lazy Boy. Nobody's going to bore you. Nobody is going to criticize you.
You know, the whole surrender to win, die to live. Do you want to be right or happy?
Yeah.
All that stuff is camouflaged so deeply because I don't want you to tell me I have to change then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want
to. Change is one of the most frightening things to people to begin with. But if you have an addictive personality and you seek comfort, there's comfort in the familiar. Mm-hmm. And I believe that most addicts and alcoholic prefer the nauseating familiar to the promise of the beautiful unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just, the unknown is so frightening to me and to most people I know. It takes trust. And if you don't have trust, that's one of the most difficult things to generate. And that's why I think it's so important to connect to people and to take those little risks of saying hi or getting out of yourself, because that fear of being rejected, of I'm going to look like a doofus, I'm going to make a mistake. And that's kind of the first bricks of the prison that we build for ourselves, is that judging how we think the future is going to unfold.
Yeah. And it all comes back to, you know, that fear of you seeing really me.
Yeah.
And the lengths we go to cover that up and camouflage our real core sense, even in recovery, is devastating. It's much like a lot of people say, it's like taking the layers off an onion till you get down to that mm-hmm. core. And often when you do that on an onion, you get down to the core and it's, you know, it's that bronze kind of dirty looking color or whatever,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a long process, and it's exciting that when you're in the process and doing that. So,
you know, that's another thing that I want to point out is how difficult it is to keep your perception of something when everybody around you has a warped perception. You know, that's why, yes. I think it's so difficult to get sobriety or to have any kind of spiritual centered life mm-hmm. in show business, or I would imagine politics or anything else where people have this just warped. You know, like I have a relative who is trying to stay sober, and he works in the fashion industry. And I can't imagine, you know, an industry with more fucked up priorities yeah. than the fashion industry. It's all about the outside and
every bit of
image.
It.
And mm-hmm. So you would better have a lot of people that are grounded, that you're connected to on a daily basis, if you are hoping to keep your priorities straight when your 40-hour or 80-hour a week job, you're surrounded by people with fucked up priorities.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's very true. Very true. And great people. fun. I mean, you'd stop. I'd stop sometimes and say, "My God, you have high school diploma, and that's it. And look at this, you know." So yeah, there's a lot of excuses for you to keep going on, whatever. And then, of course, everybody I know that's in the studios gets to a point where they live outside their means.
Yeah.
And then you have to work, and you have to get that overtime, and you have to, you know, so you trap yourself in. But
for time purposes, I had to condense this interview. Greg basically went on to say that he was sober for 18 years, but his job became more and more important to him, and he was eventually working 80 hours a week and was not doing any of the spiritual practices that had gotten him sober in the first place. And he eventually started drinking again, and that began to get out of control. And he told himself that that was okay as long as he didn't do heroin. And we pick up the story probably would have been about 4 or 5 years ago. He was watching a TV show.
They are doing a show on a heroin addict. Right? And they had this high-def shot of this heroin addict who had been sick trying to score and finally did. Okay. Now, if you're a heroin addict, that's the trap right there, because you go from like having a raging flu to a matter of a second or two putting that plunger down to nirvana. So going from like a raging flu to feeling just beyond, like nothing.
Yes, and that choice is being given to somebody who is constitutionally impatient.
Yes.
To begin with.
Yes, absolutely. And so, and they have this high-def shot, and they're watching this whole thing. Him sick, in the chair, getting the balloon open, putting it in the spoon. All full screen. You know, I'm watching it on my 54-inch plasma, right? And I'm like, okay. And I'm watching him going, this is a little graphic, right? And they do the whole thing, tying off, drawing up the blood, and putting it down, and then they pan up to his face, and they watch, you watch his transition, right? And I go, oh. And I thought immediately about my friend who runs that show. I wonder if she has any kind of editorial rights. That's a little too much. Next day, I go in for this, and check for my skin for dermatology or something. I'm at the doctor. They do the weigh-in. They said the doctor will be right in. I'm sitting in the office, the door closed. Supply nurse comes in and lays down a package of syringes, right? Now, my connections for black tar is mentally in my head. It's erased from my phone, but it's in my head, right? I see those syringes. I think about that show last night. I steal one of the syringes. I leave that hospital. I call the connection up, and there started my year and a half of shooting, speedballing. And eventually what happened was things got really dicey and shaky from there, and my crew got really, really scared and worried about me. And I was starting to have opiate blackouts and disappearing at nights and looking really bad. And my crew would get together and have talks about me. I knew it. Mm-hmm. You know, my crew loved me, and they were scared to death about me, right? And so what happened was I needed a fix. I had dope on me, and my head engineer was diabetic, and I knew he always called his insulin syringes with him. And so he went off to do a job on the lot, and I went into his briefcase and stole one of his syringes, right? Now, he had like 6 or 7 in there. I didn't think he'd miss them, which he didn't at first, but it kind of became, once I did it once, it's like anything with an addict. Oh, I can do that again. I don't, you know, I'd have to rush back to the studio doing something. And I go, God, I need a syringe or whatever. And I was so out of tune with the whole thing like that. I didn't know you can buy them at drugstores now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You can just go in and buy them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, I don't know where to get in them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the last time what happened was I went into his briefcase and there were only 3. I took one. And I thought, oh, this is
obvious,
pretty obvious, you know, because he had to inject at least twice a day, right? And that was it. And so I'm over at the boss's house, the big boss's house, at Peter Chernin's home in the middle of the day, doing some work on his screening room, and I get this call from one of the guys, and they said they're going to H&R. The whole crew got together and said they made a decision. Instead of you killing yourself, overdosing, they're going to turn you in. Right? And I was like, no, please, I'll go back into treatment. I will. I'll go right back. I'll go right. And they said, no, it's done. I think they're already up on the hill.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And you know, the funny thing, it wasn't the narcotics that got me fired. It was the stealing of the syringe.
Yeah.
That's what got me fired.
And even until that moment, there, you still lacked the perspective. You couldn't see the truth was that you couldn't handle this job.
That's right. That's right.
And
I could not stay sober with that job.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. So I got fired from 35-year career, you know. And
but that break allowed you to regain your perspective. And
I still didn't get sober for like, you know, because when I went home, there was the wife that had already started drinking in 98.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, she was still drinking her wine and doing whatever she wanted to do. But she's not anything like me. She could probably do it for the rest of her life. She'd never had any DUIs or in jail.
Mm-hmm.
She could probably do it her whole life. But anyways, all that pressure at home was just not working. So I ran with it for a while and finally ended up hitting that spot where I was done and kicked old school.
Yeah.
Kicked on my 88-year-old mother's couch. Kicked heroin, and I've been sober ever since.
Well, buddy, I want to thank you for coming and opening up, and thank you for being my friend.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
It's
funny to go through this again and try and put it all together because, you know, continuity's tough. Because there's so many different parts of my life, but thank you for allowing me to share it with you.
Yeah.
You're a good friend. I love you dearly.
Love you too, buddy. Thanks.
Thanks.
Many thanks to Greg Cheever for that great interview. Thanks to you guys for listening and supporting the show. Hopefully we make each other feel less alone and less fucked up. I would like to send you out with something my parents used to tell me. They'd say, Paul, and this is honest to God, they would say, Paul, do something that you love for a living. Because if you love it, you'll have passion about it, you'll probably do it well, and the money will take care of itself. And then they would add, but please, don't go into advertising. If you're out there and you have a product, give me a call. Maybe we'll advertise it on the show. Sorry, Mom and Dad.